you. Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very excited to be speaking to you. This is my first outing speaking about the database, so I must admit that this is the perfect group for it. So I hope you've got lots of good feedback. And of course, this is a very new project. In terms of how much has actually been put up, it's only roughly the equivalent of about 5 full volumes of 39 volumes. So it's early enough in the day to start making changes to make it a stronger database. Before I continue, I'd like to acknowledge how much effort behind the scenes has gone into this. I've had a lot of support from my institution through the Digital Resource Center, particularly Jeff Smith and John Bath, who've been the key data guys behind this, who have built the database, which I needed, and also the army of research assistants, well, the very small army, but quite a few research assistants who've done a lot of the data entry. So without further ado, this is the front page of the database. And as it stands, it's still early days. So why Sloan? Obviously, you saw him as a man of interest as well. It's very obvious when you're thinking from a scientific perspective, given that he was the center of the Royal Society in so many ways. But of course, from a medical perspective, which is the way I was approaching it, nobody had really paid that much attention to Sloan. They tended to dismiss his work as being somewhat derivative. He wasn't particularly original. So why did such a man become so popular? Well, there's a number of reasons, I think. And I think when you look at the correspondence as a whole, a number of things start to come out of it. Till fairly recently, Sloan was a neglected topic on the whole, whether or not you're thinking in terms of him scientifically or medically. And I think one of the big reasons for this is the massive size of the correspondence and how difficult it is to research. Those 39 volumes have not been itemized in any more detail than last name. Now that's okay if you're doing a scientific project and you know precisely that you want to look at Leibniz, for example. But if you want to trace patients, it becomes a much more complicated thing. Sure, you can look them up by their individual name, but that means you'll miss out on a number of other ways in which they were mentioned. For example, physicians would write on behalf of their patients, but only the physician's name will show up. Or you might have family members who write about their patients, but again, that's the name that shows up. So what I wanted to get out of the database personally was a chance to pull together all of these discrete references and to see what sort of bigger picture you could pull out. So Sloan, of course, did a lot of his studies in Montpellier, Paris, and London. And you'll see that the French stuff becomes very important when you look at the correspondence as a whole. Quite often when people have looked at Sloan's career, they've attributed his success to him traveling, becoming the household physician of the Duke of Albemarle and traveling with him to Jamaica when the Duke became the governor. And they see the Duke as being his key patron. This is why he became popular. So I wanted to tease out that idea a bit. Sloan, of course, began his vast collection in Jamaica. That was the botanical side. But of course, as we know, he collected virtually everything else. In terms of his medical honors, he had a number of those as well, which is interesting since he's widely been dismissed as being derivative. For example, he was a royal physician at a variety of points in time. He was the president of the Royal College of Physicians. So this is why I think it's important to keep the medical aspect of his career in mind. He published relatively little of his own work, but perhaps this was typical of him because I think he was a man who wanted to facilitate knowledge. And we can also see him as what one scholar has termed a super mediator, somebody who had access to many different types of patronage networks. And it's there that I think we can find some of the clues to his popularity as a physician. So 39 volumes, of which we've got roughly 5, There's between 350 and 450 folios in each of those volumes. So we're looking at getting on to about 14,000 folios. That's not letters, but that's a lot of folios to get through. The people who appear in it are collectors, scholars, patients, their families, and physicians. And the letters cover a wide variety of scientific, medical, and scholarly topics. So my project is about, first of all, making it accessible to other scholars to research. For example, typing in keywords rather than using just a name index. But it's also open access. So the back end of it means that theoretically it could be linked up to other databases, and then you could have a much bigger composite picture. And this is something that I'm presently talking to both the British Library and the Natural History Museum about. So this is the back end of the database. And I see Rob Conkle in the audience, and he was one of my research assistants. So he's very familiar with the back end here. So what this database, I hope, will also enable is, in terms of doing research, the ability to do big history. In other words, you can study the collection in detail, you can chart connections between people or among people, as well as quantifying things like subjects, diseases, or patients. But that's big history in the traditional sense of the word. However, you can also look at it in terms of pulling together individual case studies. For example, if you can pull together all of the discrete bits of these things, you can come up with entire patient case histories over a number of years in a way that we previously haven't been able to do. Or you can chart entire family patient histories. So the original scope was that I intended to do some deep cataloging. That was my initial idea. And then I thought about doing some transcription. I didn't get very far with that yet. We only have some sample letters transcribed. And then the master plan was to do some annotation of it. By annotating it, I was hoping that it would mean you could really, you know, pull out various terms. You could do entire searches. People could use it in a variety of ways. You could look, for example, language uses if you were a literary scholar. So my idea was increasingly, how could the information in the letters be used in a variety of ways by potential users? However, increasingly with the encouragement of the British Library, I'm also beginning to think of digitizing the letters, which poses a number of other possibilities as well as challenges. At the moment, we're adding to the database slowly. At last number, I think we're up to about 1,641 letters that have been entered. But at the moment, I'm stopping to take stock of what we already have and trying to think about how to expand it for the future, as well as to try to make sense of the data that I've already been collecting. In the case of the scientific letters, they go up to about 1708. The medical letters, on the other hand, are a bit more wide-ranging. So what I'm trying to think all the time is what needs to be included to make it better, and what, if anything, does the data tell us? So this is what the forms look like at the back end. And of course, we've got the typical place for metadata. It was particularly important to have different microfilm details because whilst I was doing some of the data entry from the British Library itself, I had research assistants at McGill, Toronto, Alberta, and Saskatchewan simultaneously doing data entry, but all from different versions of the microfilm collection. There's two in existence. So it's important to keep track of who precisely did what, where, when, and how. And also language. One of the things that came out is, of course, there's a substantial amount of Latin and French, which didn't surprise me. There's the occasional bit of Italian and the occasional bit of Dutch as well. So it poses its own problems. In terms of the letter description, you can class it, is it about charity or patronage? Is it about the process of collecting? More specifically, is it about science or library collecting? Is it about the Royal Society, etc.? So you can break it down in a number of ways. as well as, is it about medical or mental illness? If it's a non-medical subject, there's a nice little entry there, which is actually, it doesn't have a limit on characters you can put into it, but you can enter in the specific overview of what the letter is right there. Then, of course, date and location. Moving down, this is the key part that I'll be talking about today, is the others named section. So who gets mentioned in these letters? Because one of the things I want to do is to try to trace the networks between people to see who knew who, and in particular for Sloane's career, why did he end up with so many aristocratic patrons? As well, I've got a new field here for postal address to accompany the original one for location. My current idea is that I'm hoping through entering the addresses that we can later try some mapping with it to generate a bigger map of what this looked like. And then there's the transcription box. Then details on the author. Who was it? What's the sex? Do we know whether this, if it's a medical letter, do we know whether they were writing for themselves or about somebody else? So all of these things that you could theoretically quantify in a variety of ways. So if you wanted to enter a patient case history, you'll notice here that this is where I'd put in the most thought, being obviously a medical historian. You'll see that this differs from my current thinking for all other kinds of letters, which I didn't break down in nearly so much detail. But what I was trying to tease out of this was what can we find out about the patient? So for example, do we know anything about the description of the patient? Sometimes they'll talk about their stature, their weight. They'll sometimes mention their age. Are they elderly? Are they young? So those sorts of things. What was the ongoing treatment? What have they been taking? What remedies have they been prescribed? What is the diagnosis? What is the patient's response to the diagnosis and treatment? For example, do they like it? Are they hating it? Patients regularly complain about these things. And then, you know, for researchers, we've got this little theme section so that you could theoretically, say you wanted to search for old age. Actually, this has been triggered. Say it's a letter about an elderly woman and she complains about being old. It's now checked as aging. And so this means that if you're particularly interested in tracing elderly people, this is a good resource. And I know of at least one researcher who has been using it precisely that way. So other things like family relationships, religion, whatever that you might want to think about. And then, of course, the medical problems. For the initial medical problem section, I've tried to keep it in more early modern terminology, so thinking about palsy, apoplexy, and things like that, how they would be describing it in the letters, or according to body parts such as spleen. Now, take that, all of that lovely medical stuff, and you can compare it to the other, which includes legal, scientific, patronage, or charity. So this is the box in which you can then type the rest of the description. Now, it hasn't been broken down in nearly as much detail, obviously. That said, the database is fairly intuitive, so you can actually search it for all sorts of things, and I don't know that that poses a huge barrier at this point in time. And then again, we get back to more medical. This is now classed by the medical subject headings, which means that, you know, if you were searching Google, you could type in the current medical medical subject headings and find things through the database that way. One of the things that we have been thinking about, if we do go forward with doing the annotations, would be one reason not to pursue breaking down the scientific ones further. And in fact, it would probably render some of the patient stuff possibly obsolete already. So what I'm really interested in at the moment is trying to figure out how people were connected and how Sloane's network developed. And of course, the big question for me has been how to develop detailed case histories. So I've tried doing some visualizations with this, and this one was run through with the Yifan Fu algorithm. So more or less, something you'd expect to see with, you know, the core center in the middle, the people who are most actively involved in the correspondence. Now for this particular chart, I left Sloan out of the equation because I figured he'd distract everybody because he would be the man in the middle. Rather, here what we're seeing are the people who are corresponding with each other and being mentioned in letters most frequently. The outlying one, those are people about whom perhaps we don't have enough information yet because they may have just started corresponding or being mentioned in the correspondence, and they might have more of a relationship with others later. So they're people with whom there's no clear relationship. But you can also see spreading out as sort of radials from the middle part, you can also see a number of groupings. And I think some of those ones are quite interesting. We'll be talking about a few of those shortly. Now, this was my own attempt at doing another type of visualization. This is, you know, the old-fashioned trying to do it by hand way. And what I noticed was, first of all, with some of these groupings, that they seem to be connected to each other. So I wanted to examine these in a bit more detail. So the way I've compiled this chart is I was looking to see which families kept appearing alongside each other, as well as who they were talking about and how they connected to each other and to Sloan. So we have, of course, in this case, we've got Sloan in the middle at the center because he's got different relationships with all of these different people. The wavy lines indicate a familial relationship. The overlapping bubbles mean they're married. The black arrows mean it's some sort of reciprocal relationship, whether it's say through the Royal Society or a friendship. The green ones mean it's a patronage relationship, so say the Duchess of Bedford and Monsieur de Sass. Or you've got the red ones pointing in, and those are Sloane's patrons. And then you've got Sloane too as a provider of patronage. I'm not sure it shows up so well in this light, but he's got a few blue lines coming from him, and he in turn is a patron to those people. So lots of different interlocking relations, and if you can actually trace it all the way around the corner, and the nobles are all related in one way or another. Perhaps not immediately, but they were related at some point in time. Now, the importance of doing detailed patient case histories may seem odd to you, because what else do medical historians do? But in fact, despite Roy Porter's call way back in the 1980s about doing patient history, we've actually not progressed that far in a lot of ways. You tend to cherry pick. You've got, say, a diary, so you can find out a lot about what one person wrote about their illness. Or you can, like I have done, use the consultation letters to look at sort of a composite idea of what patients are doing on a particular topic. But that has its limitations, especially if you want to put a human face to it and start really looking at detail at one person's case history over a number of years. This is the other significant thing about this grouping, is that they were all collectively patients of Sloan's for a very long period of time. So they were loyal, very loyal patients, and they don't happen that often. So I'm hoping to put together their collective case histories. So this is the same Yifun chart here. And these are the groups I'll be talking about in particular. Because I know of your scientific interests, I'll just take a quick look at the mediaries, just for a quick overview, before looking at the three family groups in particular, the Tufton Greys, the Watsons, and the Montagues. So, here's the mediary one. This is the group that's right in the middle. And so this is a hint of the sorts of correspondence that you'll find from the scientists up until about 1708, 1709 in there. And they really are the distinct core within the letters as a whole. The biggest surprise for me was how very continental it was, since I know some people have often talked about the British scholars at this period as being somewhat isolated and not really in the thick of things. But there is a lot of back and forth going on for them. In particular, the correspondence, let's see if I can get that to work. We've got Joseph Piton de Tournefort. He's not really surprising because, of course, he was one of Sloane's mentors when he was studying in Paris. Oops. Then we've got Abbé Jean-Paul Vignon, again, not necessarily surprising, because of course he was in turn the mentor of Tournefort. So already you can see how some of these are growing. Then of course we've got Étienne-François Geoffroy, who also had interests in science and medicine. He was a physician in Paris, and in fact he also kept a large collection of consultation letters, which for my PhD I had looked at alongside Sloane's correspondence as parallel. Then down here we have Peter Houghton, again no surprise to find in this sort of collection. And then of course we've got John Ray, who famously was linked to Sloane. They were good friends as well as having an intellectual friendship. And then we've got the people involved in botany in particular in this period, Dale and Sherard. So not entirely surprising in that respect. One of the other things that did come up, because we'll be talking more about the Montagues shortly though, is that both of the Sherard brothers had also received patronage at various points from the Duke of Montague. So connected in that respect too. Then there's the Royal Society connection. So going back to the same chart I showed you just a few minutes ago, this is only showing the Royal Society relationships. When looking at Sloane's early career, again, there's a tendency to attribute his early successes to the Duke of Albemarle, but I think arguably what we could see in his collection is the importance of the Royal Society to his early medical career. A lot of his patients actually came from the Royal Society, independent of any aristocratic patronage. So even though noble patronage plays a role, the Royal Society is also important in his career. Sloane, of course, became one of the secretaries of the Royal Society in 1694. And significantly, this is also the year that he struck up a relationship with Cassandra and Thomas Willoughby. Although Pujola and Muir down here, they were Huguenot immigrants. They both taught the Duke of Montague's children, but Pujola as well was also a member of the Royal Society as of 1695. And they were also, again, Sloane's regular patients. So because Sloane was important within the Royal Society, it would have helped to attract patients. If they knew he was reliable in one way, that sort of idea of reliability extends in other ways. So we need to keep in mind, too, that by the time he starts to become actively involved in the Royal Society, he becomes somebody who can be a giver of patronage, not just somebody who's receiving it. And I think that becomes an important sort of value-added part of his practice for some patients. As well, being involved heavily in the Royal Society would have given him a bit of an aura of learning for other patients. So I think his involvement in the Royal Society was something that would have appealed to a number of patients. So moving on to how this plays out, I'm using friends here in the 18th century usage. In other words, this could apply to patronage or patronage-like relationships as much as to what we would consider a friendship today. So this is a story about how the Willoughbys and he became friends. Sloane first approached Cassandra Willoughby in 1694, and he's got the correspondence in a very rare moment of him actually keeping some of his own letters, which he tended not to do. The letters tended to be written by other people. But he actually kept his correspondence with the Willoughbys. That suggests on some level it was important to him. When he approached Cassandra, he was still a member of the Duke of Montague's household, although he was on the verge of leaving, which he would do later that year. They had a mutual friend in common, that's John Ray, who'd been his mentor initially, and they developed a friendship. Francis Willoughby, the father of both Cassandra and Thomas, had also been Ray's patron until he died in 1673, but the Willoughby patronage continued for Ray, because Francis Willoughby left him a stipend in his will that was to exist as long as Ray lived. And in fact, Thomas honored the legacy. He even increased it by £12 per annum on the grounds that his father had valued Ray so much. Sloane's letters to the Willoughby suggest that he was courting them in a way. For example, he sent Cassandra a special recipe for cashew sugar that he knew that she'd enjoyed when visiting Montague House. And they, over their correspondence, would discuss a number of botanical matters. This was important because Cassandra was busily involved in cataloguing her father's books. Sloane arranged for her brother to become a fellow of the Royal Society. The Royal Society records don't say that he nominated him, however, the letter from Sloane to Willoughby suggests that he did. He even helped Thomas to make his moving arrangements when he was coming to take up residence in London, and would be the one to introduce him officially to the rest of society when he came. Cassandra in particular became his regular patient, as the correspondence shows. She would write quite often on her own behalf as well as on behalf of her family. He also became a good friend of Willoughby's. For example, one letter from Willoughby even invites him to spend a long period at his country house that summer, especially because he was so saddened to miss Sloane recently. So initially, Sloane approached them as though they might be patrons, in a way. And he did a number of favors for them, intending to attract their attention, which it did, and they did actually become true friends. And this friendship would later become important. For example, in 1705, he then called upon Willoughby to help support Ray's widow, because of course, once Ray died, his widow was left near penniless. And so he asked, on behalf of his one friend, he asked his other friend, "Will you help out here?" And in fact, Willoughby was willing to do so. Willoughby did not have to continue his patronage of the Ray family, but did so because he was asked by Sloane. So patronage was very fluid in this period, and to be a friend had multiple meanings. It referred to the provision of tangible assistance as much as to a friendship of the heart. So just as Sloane's initial client-like relationship to the Willoughbys became one of friendship over time, so too did his relationships with both the Duchess of Bedford and Lady Sons. But not all did. If we take a look at the pure patronage relationships, there's two in particular who aren't friends, just patrons. That's the Countess of Ardglass and the Duchess of Montague / the Duchess of Albemarle. Now, the Countess of Ardglass was not directly Sloane's patron by the early 18th century, though her family had been integral in his early life in Ireland. For example, Sloane's mother had been one of the attendants to go over to Ireland with Catherine Hamilton at her marriage. And the Hamilton family as a whole continued to write to Sloane about their health. He also did a number of favors for the family via the Southwell branch. Oops, that's these two here. For example, he assisted in negotiating the marriage between Edward Southwell the Senior and the Countess of Ardglass's daughter in the late 1690s. And in the 1720s, he then later helped to further young Edward Southwell's marriage possibilities with the Lady Sons' daughter. So he was quite actively involved in that respect. The young Southwells, of course, also continued to regularly correspond with Sloane about their health. As the database grows, it may become possible to chart in more detail the ongoing relationship that the Sloane had with the Hamiltons, even from a distance. Now, one of Sloane's most important aristocratic patrons was the Duchess of Albemarle, who later became the Duchess of Montague. While it's true that her first husband initially hired Sloane as his personal physician, Sloane remained with the Duchess upon his return to England in 1689 and even moved with her to the next household when she remarried the Duke of Montague. And it's through her that Sloane met many of his aristocratic patients. For example, this is the node. Now, the node here shows a fairly heavy heavy going back and forth. And then these nice long stretchy ones that actually go through the Duchess herself. And it's those ones that are actually the really key ones. The note itself doesn't look particularly impressive. You might think, well, you know, so what? But it's actually the placement of where she was that becomes crucial. We can also see involved in this note her father, the second Duke of Newcastle, and her mother, Frances Pierpont. And both of those were families that continued to be involved. So although it looks like there's a thin number of connections, the picture when we take a step backwards. So in terms of where they are, this is them right here. This is where the Duchess is. And those little nodes that come out go directly to other family nodes. So I think it's through her that a lot of this starts to happen. Now, the importance of women and patronage fits within the growing scholarship that has been examining the roles of aristocratic women in both negotiating and providing patronage. So here, even though it's a slim node, it's on its way to important places, chiefly the Watson family and the Grey family, which were families into which her nieces in particular got married. So here we have Catherine and Elizabeth along with their parents in the family tree. So up here, that's the Duke of Newcastle and his wife Frances. This is their daughter Elizabeth, who of course became the Duchess of Montagu and Albemarle. And then we have down here Catherine, who marries into the Soane's family. This is another version of it, which actually shows her with her sisters. So here we've got, this is the one that shows Catherine Soane's right here. Her sister Margaret, who married the Earl of Coke. And although we won't be talking about her today, she does actually come up quite frequently on her own. And then of course we've got Mary, who married into the Grey family. So the Duke of Kent over here. So all three of these families show up regularly in the correspondence. So if you're thinking about being a family physician, it's not just about being a family physician to a small family, but in fact a very large extended aristocratic one. So a very large and important family if you consider them as a whole. So passing through the Duchess of Montagu, it leads on to a number of other aristocratic connections. So why was the Duchess key? Well, the care of the Duchess, or the Mad Duchess of Albemarle, which she was also called, could not have been easy. For example, in 1690 to 91, there are many letters between Peter Barrack and Sloane discussing the widow's treatment for insanity. She regularly took offense at the slightest things when dealing with her physicians, and one or both of them would always be in or out of favor with her. So I think it was a very challenging relationship. Nonetheless, Sloane did actually remain her household physician until 1694, and her family members were sufficiently impressed with her care to repeatedly seek Sloane's assistance afterwards, which they continued to do for several decades. So what did surprise me when you look at this collectively is the way in which the medical decision-making regarding the continued reliance on one practitioner in particular was being passed through the family, and this was being decided by women. This actually goes counter to a number of arguments I've previously made about men being the active ones in doing the household decision-making for the family as a whole. But that said, there may be extenuating circumstances here. First of all, we're dealing with a series of widows. The Duchess herself was a widow. And then, of course, Lady Soane was widowed very early. So when we're looking, too, at another family, the Duchess of Bedford, she also was a widow when she's doing a lot of the medical decision-making. So this question needs to be considered in more detail. And the visualization process as I go along may help to show some of the ways in which other networks developed and whether it was going through men or women and whether it was particular circumstances in each family. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Sloane also acted as a patron. For example, he provided assistance to Abraham Muir at various points. I just want to talk about Pujolo Sumira, and this is actually run in another visualization method, which is the Force Atlas one. The Yifan Hu one actually breaks up the Sloan family. For example, William Sloan appears way off, just surrounded by science, by the scientific world, which in itself I think is very interesting. But here it pulls them together a bit more. Now, Pujolus and Sloan actually had very close relationships with Thomas Eisted, Muir in particular. Thomas Eisted, of course, knew Pujolus through the Royal Society, but he was a neighbor of Muir in the countryside as well. That doesn't actually show up in this particular visualization. I'm not sure why it's not showing up yet, and that'll be interesting to find out as more letters are added. But in terms of what did come up here is the relationship that they have to William Sloan, which I hadn't noticed before. So that does suggest other links that they had with Sloan. So anyhow, I just want to talk a bit about Pujolus and Muir right now. Muir was a Huguenot, and by 1701, he'd become the brother-in-law to Moses Pujolus. Moses had married his sister. Pujolus was another Huguenot, whom Sloan knew from the Royal Society. Muir's father ran a French school in Soho, which became a prestigious place for noble sons to attend, as well as French refugees. Sloan, Muir, and Pujolus appear to have met through the Duke of Montague, since Pujolus tutored his son, and another son attended the Soho school. Sloan also provided a lot of medical care to the families of the Muir, Newdigate, and Pujolus from the 1690s to the 1730s. But the family also asked him regularly for non-medical advice, and I think it's here that we get a sense of why people were so interested in Sloan as a physician. It's because not so much of his doctoring skills, which in themselves were considered valuable, but also the fact that he could do so many favors because he knew so many different groups. Some of the things they asked Sloan to do were things like testifying in Chancery Court about Muir Sr.'s dementia, with the goal of minimizing Muir Sr.'s distress as well as trying to prevent an irrevocable decision, but also of more long-term consequences in some ways for Muir was Sloan's assistance in marrying him off. And I'm not sure what this says, that Sloan seems to keep marrying people off. That may be part and parcel of him being a super mediator. In 1708, Muir married Elizabeth Newdigate, who was a daughter of the gentry family. And Sloan had played a role in their courtship. Because Muir was a Huguenot, he wasn't exactly seen as desirable marriage by the gentry family, the Newdigates. And they put up a lot of resistance about her marrying him. She kept getting sick. They claimed she was only lovesick. They refused to pay her medical bills because she wasn't really sick. But Sloan actually stepped in to intervene on her behalf. And lo and behold, shortly thereafter, a marriage takes place. In another instance, Muir asked Sloan to intervene on behalf of his sister, whom he thought was being mistreated by Pujolus. So in other words, because he was a man in a position of authority and could intervene, this was a way that a man could actually involve himself in another man's household without anybody losing face. And in every case, Sloan helped. And in fact, Muir around 1720 wrote to express his gratitude for the manifold favors that Sloan had given him over the years by sending him 5 lottery tickets, although I don't know if those won. The story of the Muir Pujolus family is also one about the different fates of immigrants. And again, I think here the visualization gives some early inklings too about the broader framework. Pujolus is almost inevitably, although you don't get it from this particular one here, he's always connected to a larger continental network. Throughout his life, he traveled regularly to the continent, and in London, he maintained very close ties with the Huguenot community. He became very important with the Huguenot community. He even married a Huguenot woman. Muir, on the other hand, became very quickly connected to the Anglo world, into which I think he was fully absorbed. He married into the gentry, he became a prosperous landowner in Surrey, and was eventually accepted into his wife's family, even helping out his brother-in-law's financially on occasion. So it's thus difficult to know how to read Sloane's relationship with both men. Was it patronage? Was it friendship? If you look at Pujolus, The Royal Society offered a measure of equality and reciprocity between the two men, although if you look at Pujolus's letters, they tended to be very deferent, and he was a relatively minor player in the intellectual world, and his social standing was certainly much lower. As to Muir, on the other hand, by the 1720s, he was gentrified. He had broken into the ranks of the well-to-do. And like one of his Newdigate brother-in-laws, he became even a close neighbor of Sloane's son-in-law, Thomas Eystead, with whom he's occasionally linked in later correspondence, even though it's not showing up here. Otherwise, the correspondence as yet offers few clues so far into the reciprocal favors that Muir and Pujolus might have done for Sloane, but I'm hopeful that as it grows, references to either man may suggest more about the relationship. So moving on to families. So this is just to remind you about the various family connections. They're all intermarried. Lady Child was the mother of the Willoughbys, but also the aunt to the Duke of Chandos, and step-grandmother to the Duchess of Bedford. The Duchess of Montague / Albemarle is the aunt of Lady Sons and her sister, who later married the 4th Duke of Bedford, who is, of course, the son of the Duchess of Bedford. Edward Southwell, grandson to the Countess of Artglass, married into the Sons family. Then off here we have the two slightly different ones. Thomas Eystead was Sloane's son-in-law, while Pujolus was Muir's brother-in-law. So pretty complicated. I want to break this down a bit further to see what these connections within the families look like and what they might tell us. So here we have the Tufton Grey ones. It's a fairly close-looking chart. What this suggests is that I think they took an interest in each other's health and sought medical advice fairly often. And this actually matches the quantitative analysis of the letters so far. For example, in 1704, Lady Thanet wrote to ask advice about her treating her daughter's chin cough. The Duke of Kent in 1716 wanted Sloane's advice on his son's sore throat because he didn't trust, quote, the country doctors, unquote. So it's possible to get a sense of what ailments were afflicting the family as a whole from small details such as the elderly Earl of Thanet's hemorrhoids and difficulty in urinating in 1725 to the Earl of Harold's fever and swollen face in 1723. So you can use it to pull together these sorts of composite histories. So here we have the Watson one, with Lady Sons in the center. And this is a fairly lonely looking chart compared to the previous one. Lady Sons appears to be more or less on her own, except for her son down here, and, you know, a couple of physicians, right? It's not entirely true, if you look at the letters, but not entirely wrong either. Lady Sons had been widowed at the age of 30 and was left to raise 4 young children. The presence of the physicians isn't entirely surprising because Lady Sons was in chronically bad health. She suffered from, you know, debilitating pains, which were alternately diagnosed as hysteria or blood disorders. And the bulk of her correspondence with Sloane is by and large medical. She trusted him far more than her other doctors, she repeatedly wrote, and she regularly was willing to defer to his good judgment. Her trust and faith in his good judgment carried over into the personal realm. She asked Sloane for non-medical assistance on a number of occasions. For example, she was really worried about her son's governor, Monsieur de Sasse. He had been born Catholic and converted to Calvinism, and now he was refusing to take communion at the English church. This troubled her. Did this make him unsuitable for the position, especially because she was planning to send her son abroad with him in the near future? Could he be trusted? And she asked Sloane, specifically because he knew so many people, to sort of get a sense of what the general reports on Monsieur de Sasse had been. Could he verify his trustworthiness or find out if he was untrustworthy? Sloane must have replied in the affirmative, since de Sasse did in fact accompany Lord Rockingham to the continent. On another occasion, as we've already talked about, she asked for Sloane's help in negotiating her daughter's marriage to Edward Southwell, again getting Sloane to use his connections to find out whether he was really as good as he seemed. Could he fulfill the financial promise, and was he as nice as he seemed? So Lady Sons' dealings with Sloane also tell us much about Sloane as a physician. Perhaps part of his appeal as a family physician was his extensive connections. He was at the center of so many patronage networks that he had easy access to this sorts of information. But at the same time, too, you get a sense of the extent of Lady Sons' trust in him, which suggests another reason why her family tended to stick with him through the years. And then we've got the Duchess of Bedford. This is a very lonely chart, which is why I've included a picture of her, which makes the slide feel a bit fuller. The branch had few onward connections and it was freestanding. This doesn't actually seem to fit with the letters, and I suspect this is because the letters are too early to capture a lot of her later correspondence yet. This one surprised me because the Russell family was actually very actively involved in Sloane's connection. In fact, there is another grouping of some of the other Russells who appear elsewhere, pretty much on the opposite side to where she picked up. The Duchess of Bedford had a particularly close and friendly relationship with Sloane. She talks a lot about their relationship in terms of a warm friendship, him coming to stay regularly, how she'd seen his wife recently, those sorts of things. So it suggests a level of social friendship. At the same time, the Duchess was alone in a lot of ways. At the time of the correspondence, she was a young widow in her 20s who had 5 children. And she asked Sloane for many types of favors. For example, again, Sun's governor appeared to be problematic. She wanted to get rid of him, but she didn't know how to, you know, get rid of him without causing offense. So she asked Sloane to use his connections to the Cadogan family, into which his own daughter had married, to see about getting him into the army. So there were things like that. But also, one of the key issues that haunted her correspondence was her husband's death from smallpox. And by the early 1720s, inoculation was becoming a sort of popular thing to do amongst the aristocracy, but it's also very controversial. She wondered whether inoculation would be useful for them. And they kept watching all of the cases of inoculation with interest. And they repeatedly asked Sloane to keep them abreast of developments. Eventually, the children decided to be inoculated under Sloane's care in 1724, which was successful. The sad coda to the story, though, is that the Duchess contracted smallpox, probably caught from her children, and died herself within a month. But what does their correspondence tell us? The relationship again tells us much about Sloane. The family trusted him, not just with medical decisions, but a major, potentially life-threatening one, and they even entrusted him to undertake it. And this trust came in large part from the long-term friendship of Sloane to the family. For example, things like his willingness to help the Duchess find a new job for the governor. But he was also an expert. Through his involvement in the Royal Society, he would have been particularly aware of any of the ongoing inoculation cases. And indeed, he'd participated in England's first cases of inoculation, becoming such a proponent of it that he inoculated his own granddaughter. So they trusted him, both because of his friendship and because of his expertise. And once again, Sloane's presence in multiple networks, the Royal Society, friend of the family, and relation to an army general worked to his advantage. So to conclude, is visualization helpful or even necessary? Certainly a visual depiction can pull out ways of seeing the data afresh and to help make the information easier to manage. Seeing the family trees and charting out these sorts of relationships helps to reveal intricacies and overlaps. This image is a tangled mass of relationships, even amongst a small group of people, from family relations to patronage, and sometimes more than one type of relationship over time. It refers to one specific group that was connected through blood and marriage in the first place, as determined by family trees, but then broadened out to include their mutual friends with Sloane, who regularly appear in letters. But this is just one group. Sloane was at the center of many other networks too. By looking at these interconnections, it's possible to highlight particular groups for detailed study. That means you can then bring in a variety of primary sources to really get into that one particular small group. In the Yiffin Few visualization, in contrast, we saw the variety of people who appeared in Sloane's correspondence, not necessarily writing to him themselves, but were mutual acquaintances. By plotting these casual references and letters on a chart, it has the potential to uncover otherwise invisible relationships. Even at this early stage, the database is making it possible for me to identify small groups who can then be analyzed in detail, as I did with these families today. In addition to learning about the illnesses and activities of families and individuals, it's also possible to uncover the most invisible person of all, Sloane. This has been a repeated complaint that we don't know much about him. But first of all, it's possible to get a sense of how his medical practice amongst the aristocracy developed. The Duchess of Albemarle Montagu became Sloane's connection to several other related noble families. Success with one patient who is known to be difficult would have encouraged other family members to seek help. However, patronage was important in another way. Within this group, Sloan's ability to act as a supermediator was crucial. His personal qualities, such as his good judgment and willingness to help, went a long way, as the patients repeatedly stated. And the fact that the families over several generations continued to seek his help is favorable testimony about his practice indeed. That said, the favors asked by them depended on Sloan's ability to tap into his wide-ranging networks. And indeed, even from early on, we can see the overlap between things like the Royal Society and his medical practice. So the two worlds constantly stuck together. So, in short, a man in the middle of everything, such as Sloan, was a very useful man to know. Thank you.